The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, here we are again at the nightclub at the end of the world. We had a little mix-up on the music there. We normally open with Avalanche. I was going to save that song to play it, but that's all right. It would be strange from New White Trash, and everything certainly is. It is December the 4th, 2011. There are 17 days left until the winter solstice, which means that every day it gets darker longer, and I guess we could all agree that that's kind of a pretty apt metaphor for the world we're living in now. However, we know that 18 days from now, there will be more light every day, and I wish we could also have that kind of confidence that something would happen that quickly in the rest of the world, because it's pretty messed up. Going to cover a few things real quick. We have a big show tonight. We're going to pass on the commercial break, thanks to the network, PRN, so much. They let me do this for important shows. We're going to talk about some situations, and then we're going to go to three giants of the Occupy movement tonight, and I'll get to them in just a second. I know two of them are on hold now, listening in, and we're expecting a call from Shamar Thomas here pretty soon, too. So, anyway, let's get this up now. Europe, the economic collapse is proceeding, continuing at warp speed. Europe is done. And it's very clear now that 6 or 7 days is all that's left. And Mish, a.k.a. Mike Shedlock, who's been just doing some great reporting, has a story saying that Commerzbank is going to be nationalized in Germany. And it'll be the first of a great many bank nationalizations as the dominoes fall repeatedly and very hard. So that's still underway. It's still in progress. There ain't no sign. It's over. Now, with regard to Iran and Syria, we've been on CollapseNet running some stuff about World War III, which is pretty clear, has kind of gotten underway, but maybe it hasn't. Where Israel has confirmed multiple attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities. There was a special ops raid on a Syrian airbase, a very surgical helicopter insertion that took out 10 of Syria's top pilots. It wasn't Canada doing that. It was Israel. And so attacks on Iran have taken place, and the repercussions are building around the world, but there's been some hesitation. We are sitting on a deadline tonight for Syria from the Arab League, after which a no-fly zone can be imposed. Yesterday, Joe Biden called for President Assad to step down. These are all replays from Kosovo, from Bosnia, from Iran. This is like the way this plays. But other things have been moving under the carpet as that situation continues to be extremely tense. And I still think there's an agenda underway. But I think what's thrown a wrinkle into things is the fallout from this U.S. military attack on Pakistani military outposts, which killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. You don't hear this in the States, but Pakistan is absolutely outraged. And they have shut down all NATO supply truck convoys permanently going into Afghanistan to support the ISAF NATO forces there. And at the same time, Russia has made it clear that other supplies going from other regions, other countries in the region, like Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Manas Air Base, can be shut down too. So there are several messages going out right now, but I think the one that may have caught the U.S., Europe, and Israel by surprise is the realization that it'll lose an entire army in Afghanistan if they proceed. I don't know how this is going to play. There's a lot moving under the carpet. In addition to that, CIA and U.S. Marines have started leaving a Pakistani drone base as of today. We've been kicked out. The incident with the so-called friendly fire shooting of PAC troops only happened about a week ago, and CIA and the Marines are they're getting their butts kicked out of the country, and that's fine. I hope they come home safe. Now, there's another thing that's on a lot of people's minds tonight. Then we get to our guests. Is a provision in the Defense Authorization Bill, which has been approved twice by the Senate, that would allow for indefinite detention without charge of American citizens on American soil by the U.S. military. It's outrageous. We have covered this a lot on CollapseNet. Go there. We will link you to a petition by Senator Mark Udall. This needs to be spoken out against loud and clear. That bill, however, still has to go to the House, which doesn't have those provisions, and then it's got to find its way to the president. So we want to keep our eyes on this. And so we're living in a world that's getting worse even as we speak, and in the almost three-month life of the Occupy movement. And there have been a great many changes, and there are a great many things taking place. Now, I've seen a great many things happen. I'm sorry to report, after being proud of LAPD's conduct and what I saw there on the streets, there's a great article by Yasha Levine from Occupy LA that says that the conditions once in custody and away from cameras were far from friendly, and why were so many occupiers who were not violent hit with $5,000 and $10,000 bails. That's the game. So we're all adults here. Now, we have three guests that are on with us tonight, and I'm going to bring them on in a second. But this is a show about Occupy, and these guys know more about it, I think, than anybody else we could find anywhere. Four questions I'm going to pose, and then I'm going to introduce the guests and bring them on. First, how would you assess the Occupy movement at this minute? What are its strengths and its weaknesses? Two, what can we look for next? I know there's a plan to shut down all West Coast ports on the 12th. Three, what has most inspired you about Occupy? What about it makes you most hopeful? And four, in the 3 months since Occupy was born, the world has changed several times over, and conditions appear to be getting worse much faster than those of us trying to affect change. I think we're all aware that there's a ticking clock now. How has that impacted Occupy's thinking? And the people we're going to ask that of tonight are, he's been a guest on this show before, David DeGraw of Amp Status, who has been there from the start. He's always welcome on this show, very articulate guy. He's an investigative journalist, author. We also have Ian Escuela, who I don't know that much about, but I do know that Ian Escuela's name has been around throughout the course of the movement. We're going to ask him to tell us a little bit more about who he is so I can learn and ask his input. I may ask him the first question. And then we have Sergeant Shamar Thomas, who needs no introduction to anybody, except for I am extremely proud to be in this company. So, guys, if you're on the line, say hi and welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Good evening. Pleasure to be with you, Mike.
Was that Dave?
No, that was Ian.
Hi, Ian. Okay, good. Dave, you there?
I'm here.
All right.
Shamar Thomas.
Hey, Shamar. Welcome, man.
How you doing?
All right. I'm dry and I'm inside, so it's not bad.
Is that Sergeant Shamar Thomas or is that Barry White?
You got jokes there.
We don't have the bass music playing in the background. It's all right. So listen, Ian, let's start with you real quick, because I'd looked for some bio on you. I couldn't find much. You've been in this. So tell us quickly who you are and how you got involved with this bunch of psychos that we're all hanging out with. And how would you assess the Occupy movement at this minute?
Wow, that's the last part of that question is would probably take a very long time. But who I am, I'm not a giant of the Occupy movement. Just an everyday Joe, born and bred New Yorker, live in Queens now. Saw what was going on, saw the potential in it, and felt the need to get involved to the extent that I was able.
Mm-hmm.
For the past 2 and 3 months at this point, it's all a blur just in terms of time frame. I've ran around the park, been involved with various working groups, doing damn near everything I could, filling any little gap I could, and contributing any way I could.
Okay.
Hey, Mike, this is Dave. You know, Ian's a very humble, modest kind of guy, but, you know, Ian's been pivotal since the beginning, you know, making sure everything kind of trains run on time, and when you need to get something done, you can always rely on Ian. He's been, you know, a force, and I do think he is a giant of the Occupy movement.
Yeah, that's, you know, my experience around the movement has been I have met more giants per capita than ever existed in human
exactly.
history. There's just some real fine people hanging around here. Okay, so how is the movement now? We've had the series of clearly orchestrated raids following a timetable. That was pretty clear to me. That have taken down the major camps. We still have Occupy Boston, San Francisco. I'm not sure what else is still big and going strong. Has all of this affected the movement's rhythm, its tempo, its drive? How? Anybody?
I'll jump in, David. I think it's totally energized the movement. I love it. I mean, bring on more raids. The day after we were evicted from Liberty Park in New York, it was probably the most electric night when we were let back into the park. And, you know, even in L.A., the raid that just happened, the night after the raid, you know, Tom Morello, the guitarist from Rage Against the Machine, showed up, and there was a whole bunch of people, and the place was electric. I mean, this movement is constantly evolving. It's very fluid. You know, there's an evolution happening where, you know, now we're starting to get, you know, office space and evolve beyond just the camps. And, you know, this is all about, you know, direct action coming at you from every angle, and it's an organic evolution that's currently happening. And every time there's a incident of police brutality or an eviction, it just galvanizes the support for us. It's been amazing.
Let me go to Shamar with this. I'm sure, Shamar, that you and I have both seen things that we didn't expect to see as a result of your initial action. You were walking point on that, but a whole lot of people showed up right after you stood up on point. And I got to witness that here in Santa Rosa when we marched, and I spoke right before the march, and there were 8 or 9 vets there. And one guy even showed up. He had Vietnam service ribbon and jump wings with a star, so I'm assuming he was 173rd because they had the only jump in Vietnam. But and all of them were there, willing to put their bodies in the way. And then we had Captain Ray Kelly do his thing. How much more of that is there, man?
I think there's a lot more to come, especially with the new veterans returning from Iraq, and you know they're going to be coming into the populace, and they're going to be a part of this. You know, the struggles that everybody faces in America, and that's, you know. That was a difficult transition for me getting out of the military and wondering what am I going to do, you know? So, you know, with the military that, you know, with the training that you get, you know, being 17, 18 years old going into the military, you know, doesn't really, you know, go that far in the civilian world except for, you know, getting other government jobs. So.
Right. And I should also mention, I looked at your bio, Shamar, and I saw that you were at what I call Second Fallujah. That ranks at From the Wilderness, my old newsletter. I had a military editor, Stan Goff, retired Master Sergeant, Special Forces, who was writing about Second Fallujah at the time. It was some of the most compelling writing that I've ever read. And I got to say that battle's going to rank up there with the Citadel at Wei, Khe Sanh, Dak To, the Oshaw, any of them. So glad you're all in one piece. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's so amazing because when I was there, after we went through it, the generals told us before we went, like, to Fallujah that it was going to be, you know, one of the greatest battles since Vietnam. And so to understand that I was a part of that history was crazy. And then I had an amazing and a unworldly experience while I was there. You know, I spent over 10 days, you know, on top of a hill with no shelter, no cover, just 5 Marines, you know, on top of a hill for 12 days. That was, you know, at 18 years old, that was, you know, the biggest experience of my life. So
wow.
Now seeing what the Occupy Wall Street people are doing as far as putting their bodies out there on the line, it's like, you know, it's a certain level of respect that I have for, you know, what they're doing.
Yeah, you know, it's an old saying, at a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken's involved, but the pig is committed, you know, and that's what I see throughout this movement. This movement's got soul and commitment. There's some big actions, I think, coming up. Anybody know anything about this plan to shut down the West Coast ports on the 12th?
Yeah, as you said, you know, shutting down all the West Coast ports from San Diego, L.A., Oakland, Portland, Tacoma, and Seattle. you know, I'm not sure how large it's going to be or how many people are going to turn out. There was questions of how many unions would take part in this, you know, blockade of the port. You know, it's so hard to keep track of all the actions that are happening. You know, that's, you know, the port blockade is on the 12th, but then also Tuesday on the 6th, we're having these foreclosure actions to occupy homes that are in danger of foreclosure. So, I mean, literally all over the country, it's just almost impossible to keep up with all the actions that are happening.
Would it be fair to say that mainstream is giving the movement a lot less coverage now?
Oh, I absolutely think so. I mean, you know, just from what we see on a day-to-day basis, I mean, there are literally actions every single day and, you know, significant actions. So, you know, they'll focus on maybe an eviction. Even the evictions have gotten much less coverage now. The way it was coordinated, Philadelphia and L.A., those evictions were on opposite coasts, but they happened at the exact same time, even though they're 3 hours apart.
Yep.
So that was coordinated to hopefully get one news hit out of it. The media knows that they have to back off because this is, you know, quickly becoming an unstoppable force here.
What do you hear about Boston? I hear they're really going strong there.
Yeah, I've heard that. You know, like I said, Mike, it's so hard to keep up with all
really?
The areas.
Okay, I get it. Okay, because here, you know, here at Santa Rosa, we went through our own evolutions. And you can't keep track of it. It's like a fragmentation going off, a frag of consciousness expanding, and you can't keep track of all the pieces of it. What's inspired Ian you the most about this? What gives you the most juice out of Occupy?
What I absolutely loved and the people that are first in my heart now and always were the people that were on the ground making that camp happen, the people in Comfort, the people in the kitchen, our medical staff, the people that staffed the library, just all those people. They came day in, day out, damn near 24 hours a day, didn't ask for anything. If you showed up, you needed any one of the above. They were Johnny on the spot, ready to make it happen to you, and really did everything within their power to make whatever need go away for the people that showed up in those camps.
Now, I know that at Occupy Santa Rosa, we had what seemed to be a directed influence of you know, drug addicts, of people that were there for any other reason but Occupy. Is that a fairly has that been a common experience with you guys that happened in New York?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the 1% and the various economic malefactors impact people's lives to varying degrees, and unfortunately, the coping mechanism does extend to mental illness, drug abuse, etc. And one of the great things about Occupy Wall Street is that we didn't turn anyone away, that we viewed and really wanted to embrace the responsibility of trying to deal with those problems that the larger society and our larger politics and economics really shirked.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely a factor, and to greater or lesser degree and success, we tried to deal with it, but it was definitely there.
I know that we have a lot of listeners tonight, a lot of fans listening from Occupy London, London Stock Exchange. They pay close attention. They've done some inspiring work, and they have had forced, I don't know how that's played out, a debate within the Church of England, you know, which I thought was good because we need to start cracking at the foundations because things are getting pretty spicy now. Maybe Shamar first, but do you sense that people like you and Rick Kelly have had an impact? Did your actions reverberate throughout law enforcement? Do you know?
You know, I think everybody's actions, you know, kind of has made a statement. But, you know, just my video going viral, you know, it just put me on a different plateau. But this is what, you know, occupiers across the, you know, country and the world are doing on a daily basis. So, you know, I think it all has an effect. The fact that you could see it on TV, you know, on social media may have, you know, change the table, but, you know, every police officer in New York City knows who I am, you know, so it's like, you know, and me just being around the protest period, them seeing my face, you know, it kind of, you know, I could feel the, you know, it changes the tone a little bit of how, you know, they react to certain things.
I had the same experience at Santa Rosa, and that's good. That means, you know, there's at least for a lot of those guys out there in uniform, there's a few of them that have a conscience and a heart working still.
Yeah.
So, New York, you have the office space. What do you do with office space?
Ian, you want to take that one?
Okay, I might as well. Well, it just serves as a communications hub and an operational center, and it's really desperately needed and absolutely necessary now that the park has been raided. There's a massive amount of restrictions being imposed jointly by both Brookfield, the technical owner of the park, and the city of New York. They will not even allow us. Thursday night I was down there, and right after our General Assembly concluded, people donated a good amount of food, and they would not even allow us to bring food in one big bag into the park to distribute it to our people there. So we had to actually physically exit the barricades that now surround the park, go into the bag, put a couple sandwiches in our pockets and just walk it back into the park to be distributed. So the office space just allows the working groups to communicate with each other and have a base of operations and continue absent the park to fulfill their functions.
This movement is like blades of grass growing up through the sidewalk. That's what I love about it. It's just, you know, you just can't put it down. So I think one of the important things that everybody should get, and this is my perception here too in Santa Rosa and what I hear on the left coast, enthusiasm has really not died down at all. And what I'm seeing also is that this last round of evictions and the evolution has forced the movement to get leaner, meaner, and more focused, and I see it doing that. Anybody?
Well, I agree with you absolutely. You know, the movement is growing. You know, in working with, you know, decentralized strategy, you know, you always have this. You know, you have a core idea. All of a sudden, the core idea explodes, and you have, you know, thousands of people acting on their own, and you have this explosion within the movement, and then you reach this next phase where, you know, you get a lot of the chaos, which leads to people kind of internal fighting and vying for power. But then you have this other subset within that chaos who focuses on you know, creating constructive work, and they focus on their autonomous projects. And essentially you have this, you know, rising to the top of the people who keep focused on doing the hard work, as opposed to the people who just, you know, kind of like to argue over everything. And I think that's kind of in the phase that we're in right now.
Yeah.
And so I've been focused, and I know Ian has as well, on trying to get some kind of national structure in place. There's something that started called InterOccupy, where we've connected over 250 camps so far to open up the lines of communication. So I think through these winter months, over the next 3 months, you're going to see a much more organized national coordination. Not that we want to keep the decentralized, leaderless nature of the movement, but there's no reason why we can't be much more organized than we are now. And everyone just needs to keep in mind that this movement started, you know, on September 17th. It's really just in its infancy. So, you know, we have a lot of growing pains to iron out. But I think come the spring, come, you know, March, April, you're going to see a much more organized effort and much more effective, larger scale numbers in the actions. You know, I'm very confident that the future is very bright for this movement.
Which Occupy encampments that are still there are really planning up to weather a cold winter? Buffalo, I guess, where?
Well, it's funny you ask that, not so funny you ask that, as, yesterday Occupy D.C. erected a structure specifically to deal with the impending change of weather. And as of this afternoon, the police said that was not permissible, moved in, arrested at last count, to my knowledge, 24 people, and people boarded, got on top of the structure and held tight, and the police were required to deploy a cherry picker, armored car, and at this point, God only knows what else to try and dislodge them from the top of the structure. And right before your show, I was watching the live stream from D.C., and one gentleman, I don't know his last name, but his first name is David, is still holding tight on top of that structure, and the crowd is chanting something, pointing out the irony of the David versus Goliath. So.
Beautiful. I just love to see this working. We're going to come up on the bottom of the hour, and in a second I'm going to stop to play a song so I can gather my notes. If you want to call in tonight and ask questions of David DeGraw, Ian Escuela, or Shamar Thomas, the number is 1-888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Or you can email me directly, as two people just did, at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. That's where you can find me, at collapsenet.com, 7 days a week. We're going to take a little break and come back. When I come back, I'm going to pick up with this, and then we'll go into calls. Guys, everybody can see that the world's going to hell in a handbasket at breakneck speed. And when we come back, my question will be, how does that affect the way you as occupiers think about what you have to do and how you're going to go about it? Right now, we're going to take an emotional mental break, get some music, get our rhythm tune up again. We'll be back right after we play a song called It Would Be Strange, featuring my good friend Michael Yost on electric guitar, and a great line, "Don't let the fear turn my ears and eyes off." We'll be right back. That's one of the best songs we did at New White Trash, newwhitetrash.com. It Would Be Strange. Tip of the hat to my bandmates Doug Lewis and Andy Kravitz, who really did a heck of a job on that song. Anyway, we're back on the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM, going without a station break tonight, except for that song. We always play a song anyway, just to get our heads right. Before I went to the break, we got some calls and emails stacking up. I asked our guests tonight, Dave DeGraw, Ian Escuela, and Shamar Thomas, if the rapidly deteriorating exterior situation in the world is affecting anything, is it helping Occupy to focus on what it wants to do? Who wants the first crack at that? Dave?
Sure. Mike, you know, I mean, I've been living like at the end of a fire hose since this thing began. Uh-huh. I mean, literally, you know, 24/7, you know, if I can get 4 hours of sleep a night, that's a great night.
Wow.
So I couldn't imagine, you know, I mean, speaking personally, you know, I've obviously, you know, been doing investigative reports on the breakdown of the global economy and the growing prospects of wars. So, you know, I can't operate any faster or harder than I am right now. So,
okay, yeah, and that's, Dave, something I see totally across the board from everybody involved. You know, I know that when I'm entertaining things I'd like to see done, I'm putting it up against this hard wall of events outside in the world right now. And I firmly believe that that Occupy is the last best hope for the human race. And no pressure here. Let me see if Ian or Shamar wants to.
Well, I'll say that. You know, I totally agree with you. Dealing with life in society and just being a regular human being and, you know, going to school and just understanding how life is going is unbelievable. It's unbelievable how complacent everybody is to what's going on. And I feel like this movement and the fact that, you know, people are, you know, really out here, you know, sleeping overnight and, you know, doing, you know, orchestrating these direct actions that, you know, speak volumes of the, you know, to the issues that are, you know, really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is honestly our, you know, our last chance. If we, you know, with the support that we already have, if we can't capitalize on the support that we have, you know, it's going to be a bad day.
You guys better be careful. You're going to start to give me hope here. I like that. We have a caller on hold on the line. Aaron from Portland. How you doing, man? You there?
I'm doing well. How are you?
All right. What do you got for our great guest tonight?
Well, just speaking of the evolution of Occupy Wall Street, the biggest issue for me is localized food production. Portland and my neighborhood, we've got a good number of people who have their own gardens. But I was just wondering if the guys in New York, if they had any plans to help implement a localized food production so we can slowly start getting away from the destruction of agribusiness.
That's a great question.
In general, things like that.
That's also happening, by the way, I should say, in Santa Rosa as a result of the stuff that that I was involved with here. The occupiers got the complete support of local permaculture giants like Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. Transition U.S. was helping. And Transition is having another fund drive. We're going to have them on before the end of the year. But there's been like this community support to really get involved in occupying some land here and growing our own food. That came up in L.A. So I'll shut up with that. Now you guys can talk about it.
I'd love to take that. I mean, the city of New York and a lot of the other cities that have rated centralized encampments, I don't really think took a very long view at the ramifications of their actions and how that would really encourage the diffusion of the Occupy movement into various neighborhoods. And once that diffusion occurs and there is that localized community base, the logical next step is to really deal with the needs of that community and the needs of that we all commonly share as humans, one of which would be the production of food.
Absolutely.
And personally, I'm going to push, and I really want to see, come springtime, come planting season, a real spread onto public land, not only on private land, but onto public land.
Yes.
The growing, planting, and cultivation of food for that community and communities more broadly.
When Cuba lost its oil subsidy from the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, It lost all of its fertilizer, and it had one of the worst food crises in human history. And what the Cuban government did was it told people to go onto any piece of arable land that was not being cultivated and cultivate it. And that saved Cuba. And actions like that are going to be necessary here sooner or later for everybody. We have another caller here. Does anybody want another crack with Aaron's question? Okay, he's gone. All right. Alex in L.A., are you there?
Yeah, it's Alan, Michael.
Alan, hi. Alan, I recognize your voice.
How are you? Well, I'm hiding from my wife, so it's easier to watch porn in my house than to listen to your radio show and recollapse, and my wife will say I'm all negative. I was just calling Sergeant Thomas. I haven't cried much in my life, but watching your video probably about a half a dozen times, I've never cried more, and just the hope for humanity. My grandfather was a Marine at Okinawa and Peleliu, and he would be proud of you. My question for you, Sergeant, is Michael and I have a mutual friend in common, a good friend of mine who was also with Sergeant Major Goff in Special Forces. The questioning that's coming from a lot of the community, especially guys who've served and have served for a long time, with regard to Sections 1031 and 1032 with the Senate bill, they almost have a complete, they're apoplectic. And I want to know what your thoughts were, having just been fresh to the battle and having been over there, you know, protecting, doing your job, and coming back here to find these type of things going on. How do you sort of respond to that? Because it's absolutely sickening to me, especially when you have Jewish congressmen, I'm a Jew, and we have Jewish congressional leaders actually proposing this. It almost feels like the world is sort of turned upside down. I just want to get your thoughts, having come out of the battle recently and coming home to this and watching this play out on C-SPAN. And just this sort of complete sort of, most people don't even know that it's actually happening, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on how that makes you feel and your thoughts on the matter.
Well, I'll start off by saying that, you know, being, you know, that video, I can't even watch it just because it's like, it's unbelievable the passion that, you know, came out of me. I'm amazed that, you know, how, you know, I even look at myself. So, you know, I really appreciate the comments. But, you know, as far as the veterans that we have now is that, you know, I put them in the same category as the police almost, where, you know, you're in a military structure where, you know, everybody has the same common goals. Everybody, you know, makes around the same amount of money. You know, it's a secure, you know, place. You know, you can leave your doors unlocked on, you know, military bases. And so, you know, there's a certain kind of complacency that you have where, you know, people believe in symbolism more than, you know, what we're really doing. You know, it's about the American flag. It's about, you know, being a Marine. It's about being a soldier. It's not about, you know, what's right and wrong. And it's like, you know, for people to consider themselves warriors and, you know, not stand up against the oppression is like, you know, it kind of, it's a little disheartening. So, you know, that's pretty much my stance on everything. As far as how the government, you know, treats its veterans, you know, is a reflection of society, you know, how, you know, we can send, you know, these young men off to war, but, you know, we don't want to take care of them in the end. And you know, the blatant disregard that, you know, that they show to the servicemen, you know, in front of everybody, and it's okay. It's like, you know, I just, you know, I can't live that way.
My take on the proposed detention measures are that they are not intended for large numbers of Americans. I think they are going to serve the same purpose as the detentions did. They are intended to serve the purpose as the detentions of Japanese Americans did after World War II in the event of a major war in the Middle East, that like the one we're potentially facing now. I'm recalling a line from Michelle Chelsadovsky, an old colleague, a great writer who's often ahead of his time. I think he said that if there's an attack on Iran, there will be war from the Mediterranean Sea all the way to China's borders, and that's the truth. And I think that they're planning on rounding people up for that. I might have a follow-up with that, though. It's a good thread. Shamar, I totally get how you how you react to that. That's the way I felt after I saw the tape of me confronting the CIA director a long time ago, you know. you kind of get used to it. I made my own tape about this stuff, and the emotions that it brought up. What I got for me out of this, Shamar, was when...
Michael, excuse me, I have to hang up. My wife's calling me, and she's going to come in here in 8 minutes, so I feel like a 13-year-old sneaky porn. I got to go. I'll listen to you guys
Goodbye,
later.
Helen, thanks for calling. Everybody say a prayer for Helen.
All right, peace.
What I got out of it was that it was extremely pure. It was an extremely pure moment. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or not, but
yeah.
It was, and that's what was so powerful about it all for me. Now, my observation, and of course I get a lot of good intel here, that's what I do, is that you, me, Captain Kelly, we have all sent major ripples throughout law enforcement. Now, I cannot see U.S. military coming home if they're coming from Iraq, or, you know, even if it's guard, whatever, here. Enforcing these laws against Americans, I'm thinking there might be some soldiers who will refuse to follow those orders. Shamar, what do you think?
I think there's going to be a lot of soldiers that will refuse to do it. I was with Third Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, and just the Marines that I was with, just how we conducted ourselves in Iraq in theater, I just couldn't imagine them coming on U.S. streets and firing on unarmed civilians or, just the population period,
right.
Based on what's happening. Because, if we go to war, a lot of, I understand that we all consider ourselves warriors, but if we go to another war and, it really starts to, set in that, you're going to be doing multiple deployments to, a fresh new war with the, a military that's, a little bit more equipped than the Iraq, military and, the insurgents that are fighting in Afghanistan. It's going to be, a different kind of battle.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure if people are mentally ready for that right now.
I'm not sure if anybody's mentally ready for any of this, okay. But it seems to be here nonetheless. When people have to choose. And the sooner everybody have to choose, then the sooner we know, where the chips are going to fall. We have a question from Andrew, who writes in, I saw Anthony Arnov, I don't know who that is, and Noam Chomsky speak tonight in memory of historian Howard Zinn in response to a question about Occupy. Arnov said that he's really inspired by the consensus practices being used, which are also one of the movement's big drawing points. But he's concerned about its potential to limit the growth of the movement. He mentioned Joe Freeman's essay, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, and suggested some ways to open up the decision-making process so that it's accessible to more people, such as neighborhood meetings. Any comments on consensus and movement growth? That's a great question for you guys. Who wants it?
Okay, I guess I'll do it by default. From the beginning, as the movement grew rapidly, there was the limitation imposed on the people here in New York that we couldn't use amplified sound, so automatically we got innovative and went to the people's mic on several occasions, actually having a second repetition. But there are massive limitations. There are open source working group here in New York has been dealing with many different options as far as incorporating technology, be it cell phone based, internet based, to broaden the movement. And there was also efforts to comprise a spokes council that's still ongoing, and that initiative was taken prior to the raid to really give greater voice to the working groups that were operating on the ground in the decision-making process. But in terms of a broadening, I liken it to the old town meeting, that once you have a movement that's diffuse in neighborhoods, in various communities, that there is it is an indigenous movement, and that neighborhood can assemble relatively easily, hopefully, compared to a broader participation in a localized space and hash out the needs and wants of their community and their own internal politics.
I know that Shamar will get this. My observation, having done the deed at Occupy Santa Rosa, is that As the affinity groups pull apart, you know, and start working, and you really find core groups of people who work together, you find, the more they work together, the better they get at it. I see facilitators getting better. I see, you know, I see there's a learning curve with this, and I do see a lot of progress.
This is David. Yeah, Mike, it is, you know, it's amazing because you start out and it's impossible to get, you know, 90% consensus or just general consensus on whether we should serve the food in this side of the park or that side of the park or anything at all. But as time goes by, you know, organically people learn how to agree with each other. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think we're quite to that point yet. There's still a lot of infighting, but you know, I mean, we're getting there. It's an organic process. Just real quick, I wanted to say to the Howard Zinn point, I have a great story with Howard Zinn. I had an email relationship with him, and before he had passed away, I had recently started with this whole 99% concept, and he wrote me this great email saying that he thought the 99% was, you know, a great idea. And he was very positive in his, you know, praise for that. And it was just an amazing thing. And then, you know, unfortunately he passed away. But, you know, Howard Zinn would just, this entire Occupy Wall Street thing was exactly what he spent his entire life working towards. Really just sad and unfortunate that he wasn't around to see it. Hopefully, from above, he's enjoying it and helping guide us.
Yeah, he probably saw it from just another vantage point. Let's put it that way.
Oh, Michael, sorry.
Go ahead.
My phone went on mute for a second. I just wanted to answer your question because I just came from 60 Wall Street earlier today, and I went to, you know, every affinity group that there was, and it was, you know, it was like that was – you know, the way that the groups are, you know, they're more important to the movement more than ever right now because, you know, Satati Park is not, you know, the central base anymore, so to speak. So, you know, the groups are all working together. You know, I even got asked to be a facilitator. Like, they have, you know, the facilitators going around to the different meetings. Like, but, you know, I was there on October 5th. From October 5th to, you know, right now, the, you know, the general consensus around everything is that, you know, how, you know, just ways to make everything better. I feel like, you know, a lot of things are running a little bit more smoothly.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see that happening, too. So I'm just kind of waiting to see how the movement flowers again. Maybe I'm sensing we all kind of look at it as like, okay, what's going to happen next? Where? You just got to keep your eyes out to see what's going to catch quick and on how it's going to work, but there's a ton of creativity. We have an email from Matt. Okay, it's a long one. Let me go fast. As collapse moves forward, it seems to me that we have a race against time in the sense that the real underlying physical conditions of the economy and the environment, and the environment's a whole separate story, thanks for mentioning it, can no longer sustain exponential growth, and yet the lies of politicians and the media, the BS statistics, and the deeply ingrained tendency of people to believe in the inevitability of progress and growth are able to sustain. Okay, it's kind of a lecture. Where's the question here? Okay, we need popular resilience that can have the effect of the 99% throwing their bodies on the gears, stopping the machine before it does more damage to the systems that we are going to need to survive and build a new world after collapse. Could either of the following possible tactics derail the global Ponzi? Okay, it's hypothetical. Rolling debt strikes, millions of people in an orchestrated action of either outright default and or paying their monthly debt payments 1 month late, a global strike, labor unions, the indignados, OWS, environmentalists, peace and justice activists, anti-globalization folks, the Arab Spring activists, everybody strike everywhere all at once. This would require some networking and planning, but maybe this spring the time would be ripe. I don't know. That's you might not want to talk about those plans if you know about them. But go ahead, anybody.
You answered it, Mike.
Okay.
we're getting there. We're getting there. Obviously, it is going to take a lot of organization. We're struggling to organize on the national level, let alone the international level. But we're getting there. We will get there.
Sounds to me like we're looking for the 100th monkey.
Exactly. We're at 99 right now, right?
Somewhere around there. I want to give a shout-out tonight. I meant to do this earlier, to Irish writer-director Connor Horgan. He wrote, produced, directed an incredible movie called 100 Mornings. My old friend Stan Goff tipped me off to this a while ago. I wrote to them, and they sent me a review copy. I had meant to write a review, but, you know, life got in the way. But the movie is pure poetry, and it's basically an end-of-the-world, you know, a collapse scenario. But the movie is absolute poetry, and 100 Mornings is now available on video on demand. It's worth your time because there's such crap out there everywhere now anyway. If you want to see something really good, makes you feel like you got some calories from it, go to www.100mornings.com. That's from Blinder Films in Dublin, Ireland. I just had to give them a shout. I shamelessly promote people I like. What can I tell you? Okay. We're down to the last 8 minutes or so. And I'm going to think of 200 questions that I would want to, you know, I'm sorry I didn't ask you guys. So what I'm getting tonight, and I have to admit that I came into this show being a little bit down because of the world at large, and you guys have lifted my spirits a lot. That's a good thing. Do we think it's going to be fairly quiet through the winter?
I don't necessarily think so. I think the people sleeping outside might be a little bit different, but, you know, I think with the social media that, you know, direct actions will, you know, still be able to go through the winter.
All right, and I'm sure there's going to be a very large support network built up for those occupying encampments that are going to be really facing the elements. Shamar, earlier when you said five Marines on a hilltop with no cover, I said, well, that's the way the Marines do things. Army guys build bunkers, you know.
My mother's in the Army, though. Don't get me in trouble.
They engineer them, you know, and they, you know, put heaters in there, actually, on occasion. That's the way the Marines do it anyway.
You better start a war. Oh, man.
Have any of you guys had any contact with Captain Ray Kelly?
Other than seeing him at the park,
right.
No. I mean, you know, at the park he talked briefly when he came in uniform and got arrested. But no, I don't know. Ian, have you talked to him at all?
No, not recently.
Okay. Go ahead.
I've heard a little bit. We have a mutual friend that is doing something. He's in an internet work group who's doing Voices of the Movement, and he did a little article about me and, you know, Captain Ray. And he was telling me that, you know, he's, you know, planning on starting a whole bunch of, you know, different initiatives. And, you know, he's eagerly trying to, you know, get involved in, you know, lending his hand and whatever he can.
I think we're going to see a lot more, you know, not just former police officers, but, you know, men who are currently serving in the police academies, stepping forward and supporting us. You know, I come from a family of a lot of police officers. The town I grew up in is generation after generation of police officers. And I have, you know, private conversations with them. And, you know, they get it. Unfortunately, they feel as if they have a job to do. And, you know, they're financially struggling, too. They're struggling to pay their mortgage. And they're worried about their pension. They see how Wall Street companies are raiding their pensions and taking crazy risks. And I mean, they get it. Unfortunately, they're just in a tough spot. And I think as time goes by, you'll see more and more as they feel comfortable with the movement and as the economy continues to deteriorate. I think once the police join us more frequently and more vocally, you know, that's going to be when we really start to win this thing. You know, people like Shamar and the veterans and soldiers stepping up. The more that happens, you know, that's like the corporate elite guard stepping away. And then at that point, we win.
That's what George Orwell said, you know. And George Orwell said a couple of things. He said that
when those who rule the world have done so through the use of fraud and force. And when the fraud is discovered, only force remains. And he also said those that enforce for the powers that be stop enforcing, it's over. And that's the case of every successful revolution in history. And that's what we want, is for the enforcers to stop enforcing. I'll just throw out a little thought about something that I thought might be an interesting confrontation to stage here or in any place around the country that's amenable. Is hypothetically, we're from Occupy Santa Rosa evolving to occupy some land, go into permaculture, grow food, permanently occupy, and the food will be organic, there will be raw, and to build ties with the community against that point in time when the FDA shows up and says, you've got raw milk, you're committing a felony, which is about the same thing as putting $10,000 bail on Occupy LA misdemeanor arrestees who were nonviolent. Sun Tzu's in his Art of War made the point that when you're outnumbered, you must pick and choose your battles carefully. And it's the picking and choosing, I think, that has also impressed me so much about this movement. We're all guys. You guys need to help me find some of the great women of the movement so I can have them on the show. Because I see them
there's
everywhere.
There's plenty of them around. Mike, I'll talk to you after the show or I'll send you an email. There's a whole bunch of them. Women are very prominent and powerful within this movement.
Women are, well, you know, it's been my position for a long time that I will look forward to the point in time when women actually get back in control again, because they'll be smart enough to realize it has to be shared. But the feminine influence is exceedingly important, and I see a lot of feminine strength and flexibility. I remember one of the things I was most impressed by when the movement first started was that everybody got down and spit shined the camp, you know?
And Mike, can I just say this real quick?
Yeah.
Occupy LA today, you know, a lot of it is blocked off. People can't put up tents. Grandma Ruth showed up today.
Oh.
It was about 20 older women. They showed up and they put up a tent, and about 20 police surrounded her and told her to take down the tent. And they mic checked the police and said, no, it's not happening. And then the police backed off. So this 80-year-old woman, Grandma Ruth, held her tent up there when there was supposed to be no tents. And last I heard, she's still there with her tent.
I love it. I love it. I'm in awe, and it's nice to be on an asymmetrical battlefield where allies come in all different shapes, colors, sizes, age, recipes, flavors, and everything else. You know, it's just a great thing. We're about out of time, guys. I want to thank all of you, David DeGraw, Ian Escuela, Jamar Thomas. I'd love to hang and talk with you more. Maybe we'll get a chance to hang and drink a beer someday. But in the meantime, I want to thank all of you so much for coming with us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. Y'all are welcome back anytime, and I got your six.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Mike.
All right,
thanks,
guys.
Lot,
love you.
Mike.
Take care and good luck. Good night, everybody. It was a great show. I'm going to go have some dinner. See you next week.
Good night, all.